That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hello and welcome to The Bunker. I'm Arthur Snell. Matthew Hedges is a British expert on the Middle East. In 2018, while doing research for his doctorate, he was arrested in the United Arab Emirates, accused of spying for the British government and given a life sentence. Happily, he was pardoned later that same year on the UAE's National Day and is now able to live in freedom in Britain. Matthew has written a book about the UAE, about the much bigger issue of how that country has reinvented itself under its crown prince, Mohammed bin Zayed. Matthew, welcome to The Bunker.
Hello, thank you very much, Arthur, for having me.
So, Matthew, inevitably, we're going to talk a bit about your own personal experiences. Perhaps you could just quickly give the account of that story, your experiences and what it told you, both about the UAE, but also about Britain's relationship with that country.
Sure. I suppose in summary, I'd recently undertaken 2 weeks of field research in the UAE. When trying to leave the country, I was stopped by state security personnel and told I had to go with them. You don't really have an option. You just have to mediate it as well as you can do. I was then interrogated for a week by two to three nicer, more engaging gentlemen. However, this evolved to accusations of me working for the British Foreign Office and subsequently MI6. I was asked to steal documents from the Foreign Office, and obviously I had denied all these accusations. I was simply there undertaking research for my PhD. And I was then introduced, to put that politely, to two new interrogators for a period of about just under 2 months. I was with these two every day, sometimes being interrogated for up to 15 hours. They forced me to take medication. They denied me sleep. They kept me in quite poor conditions, and they tried to be careful about not physically abusing me, but when it came to psychological pressure and torture, this is something which was permissible by them because it's not something that you can tangibly show and illustrate. I was then held for a total of about just under 8 months, where I was held in, prolonged solitary confinement the entirety by myself in a room with the lights, the strong blinding lights on. I was later put on bail for about 2 weeks. I was taken to court, and then I was later sentenced to life imprisonment. And then about 4 days later, I was granted a presidential pardon. It was quite strange for many different reasons. Not only because the UAE was accusing the UK of these acts, but also the Foreign Office's reluctance to engage with this whole process.
Now that you're out, and hopefully you're able to put some of that very traumatic experience behind you, what is your conclusion about what the British government did or didn't do and the reasons they might not have done it?
In some ways, they tried to... It seems, from my perspective, hope and see that it would take a natural course of action that would result in a somewhat positive outcome. I don't think they understood the accusations that were being put against me, as well as the fact that even though it's well recorded that there is widespread abuse and torture ongoing within the UAE's judicial system, they seem to forget that, ignore that fact in my case. I was asked when I was able to speak to the British Embassy later when I was on bail why I had admitted to it in court. This was by the deputy head of station in the UAE who had previously worked at Amnesty. She asked me why I admitted to it in court, and that lack of empathy and understanding shows quite a strange rose-tinted view of these affairs. There was also a very distinct difference between the Foreign Office in London and persons within the embassy in the UAE.
We could talk about this story for a whole podcast series, but I do want to get onto your book, Matthew. It's a fascinating book, Reinventing the Sheikhdom, Clan, Power and Patronage in Mohammed bin Zayed's UAE, published by Hearst. Something that I also picked up from reading your book is that really, in fairly recent history, the UAE was a very turbulent place with endless assassinations, seizures of power, infighting, and so on. So perhaps for the listener who, when we talk about the UAE, they just think of the skyscrapers in Dubai, can you give us a quick description of what is this country and how has it evolved in the last 40 years?
Sure. So in a very, very, very quick and broad overview, the UAE first and foremost is a federation of seven different emirates. These are more than simply counties. These are microcosms of like quite delicate social, political dynamics and relationships. They are extensions of families. They're tribal networks who have quite close association between them. Over time, the power has shifted between these different emirates for reasons of commerce, for reasons of natural resources, and many other issues. However, over time, power has increasingly centralized and solidified within the southern emirate of Abu Dhabi. Dubai is quite a small emirate. It doesn't have much or if any natural resources. And it's really because of that that the Emirate of Abu Dhabi has been able to consolidate power. Under the ruler, the founder of the UAE, Sheikh Zayed, he lived in a world which was, as you said, rife with internal conflict, both within his own immediate family, but also across the entire federation. He succeeded in forming the UAE and getting these tribes and groups to work together. However, over time, their independence and autonomy has decreased. This process then accelerated upon his death in 2004 when his eldest son, Sheikh Khalifa bin Zayed, took over. The crown prince at that time was then Mohammed bin Zayed, MBZ. And he has overseen a process of, it's somewhat of a parallel state, whereby he's used his networks and connections within the military, within the security services, and within certain economic and industrial areas and groups to create and establish formal and informal networks that have fundamentally given rise to a new generation of political and social leaders.
MBZ is at the heart of your book and at the heart of this story, but unlike the sort of similarly named MBS of Saudi Arabia, he hasn't really become such a prominent figure on the global stage. So I think it would be worth focusing on him a little. What sort of a person is he?
It probably wouldn't be a surprise to many listeners to understand that his background, he was the third son of the UAE's founder, Sheikh Zayed. He wasn't in the direct limelight of political succession. He hadn't had as many political roles and instead took a path through the military and has really used and exploited that power network to transition into the political sphere, because many of those persons that were trusted to go into the higher echelons of the security services are also those that holds significant political clout. In essence, he has kind of reshaped those traditional networks to center around him. He's known to be a degree of inflexibility. He's quite forthright in his views and his positions. He always knows what's going on. He has that direct relationship with the executioner in a certain department. He's always involved in that process. And this really tells and shows you his attention to detail and focus in governance.
So in that case, do you think he was personally aware of and focused on your own case? After all, accusing someone of spying for a close ally seems like an important issue.
It's nearly impossible that he wouldn't have known.
You mentioned his overseas activities, and certainly that's where MBZ and the Emirates itself appears to have really transformed its profile. I'm thinking about involvement in the war on Yemen. I'm thinking about involvement in the ownership and the establishment of ports in parts of Africa, land holdings in Africa, forward-leaning military engagements in quite a lot of environments. But also, underlying that, there seem to be some very determined kind of ideological pillars. MBZ is kind of obsessed with Islamists, and he's obsessed with the threat from Iran. Could you say a bit about that and whether or not it's fair to characterize those things as obsessions?
Rightly so, that you've noted the transformation of their international profile. They have certainly been at the forefront of many events following the Arab Spring. And if you follow this back, you'll see that it's all been a part of quite a stringent and quite a tough learning process for them since 9/11, when they actually tried to purchase many of the management rights to ports in the US. They have heavily utilized and exploited many shared concerns with, in particular, the US. Again, this comes down to, you know, anti-Iranian efforts, anti-political Islamist elements. And they have used this to legitimize many of their overseas operations and interactions.
One of the things that makes the UAE unusual compared to the sort of comparable countries in the region is that it has become a major tourist destination. And it's almost as if there's a parallel society, particularly in Dubai. How do you think the sort of the ruling class of the Emirates, and particularly sort of MBZ, how do they feel about, on the one hand, ruling a conservative, Islamic-based Gulf monarchy, and on the other hand, having a one of the sort of global hotspots for sort of licentious tourism on their shores?
Sure. It's a really interesting question, because they are legitimizing and using a certain view of Islam that should be apolitical. There's a way of maintaining a separation between politics and religion. They are absolutely socially conservative, but they also defer to the government as and when. There's an understanding, a social understanding, that not only has the country developed extremely quickly in such a short amount of time, but that they need that diversification to continue. They need that to survive for the future. And so when they speak about state building, nation building, development, many of these projects, building these great skyscrapers, these massive roads, attracting the world to their shores, creating satellites domestically, are a signal of the state's development. The citizens may look down upon other states within the region, such as Saudi Arabia or Kuwait or Oman, as being socially backward, that they aren't as developed. And so that there's a way of using the results of modernity that have enabled the country to develop and grow, albeit one that is certainly at odds at their historical identity, but they're using that to legitimize the behaviors of the state. You've seen recently in Saudi Arabia, you know, these videos of outdoor clubs of people engaging. I think the way in which, if you're a state such as the UAE now, you are appealing to the international arena and your own reputation as much as you are domestically.
Now, one of the things that has been a feature of the sort of post-2011 settlement, and you've already referred to it, but it's worth sort of going into a bit more, is the degree to which it has become a surveillance state. And my understanding is that during the COVID pandemic, this has been even more the case, partly, of course, for sensible public health reasons. But as I've been told by people who traveled there during that period, that the version of the sort of COVID app that many countries have is incredibly intrusive in the Emirates, perhaps not surprisingly. So it's interesting that it's become a sort of extreme surveillance state, but it's also become almost a bit of a petri dish where new technologies are tried out by innovators, often with connections to Israel. So I suppose it'd be interesting to talk a bit about that and then perhaps address that question of the peace treaty with Israel, which again is a sign of this evolution of where the Emirates is going.
Absolutely. And, you know, when we speak about that state control, it is legitimized for the greater good. It's continuously lauded as having one of the world's best crime records and safety records. And this, of course, is a good thing, but kind of at what cost? The citizens themselves can often have their nationality stripped. If you are a foreign person, you know, you may commit a small law or a big law, but ultimately they can decide quite arbitrarily to simply deport you. And so when we look at the wider surveillance state, the legislation only supports and protects total oversight, but the actual framework of you connecting, using a mobile phone, connecting to the internet, is all linked to your own personal identity. It's linked to your SIM card, is linked to your ID. And of course, they have the money and ability to continuously watch every form of digital communication that takes place. It's a certain ethical question, but if these laws aren't enacted openly, this is when issues become, abuse can take place. When we look at, you know, the responses to COVID and everything else, again, this is legitimized for that greater good, for health reasons and so on. It doesn't mean that these are innately good tools, but they're just good tools at social control.
And as I mentioned, quite a lot of these are based on technology that's come from Israel, and that seems to be part of a wider move, which involves both the normalization of relations, a peace treaty, but also, perhaps more importantly, particularly in the person of Sheikh Tahnoon, who's the head of the intelligence services and a brother of MBZ, the increasing involvement in Israel in the security of the state, whereas, of course, not so long ago, Israel would have been seen as a sworn enemy of the state.
So, again, this does come back to that, to the point I made earlier about a degree of modernity and opening up. Socially, it's very difficult to gauge what the population thinks about the relationship, the UAE's relationship with Israel. But for the UAE as a state, it wants to be seen as forward-looking, as engaging, and not being, by contrast, it's like a self-orientalist type of view. It doesn't want to see itself as backward. It doesn't want to see itself as some Bedouin tribe who's simply stuck in the past. It's about moving forward and trying to be somewhat pragmatic. From a technological and financial perspective, Israel is absolutely at the forefront of surveillance and security products and services. And it really does emphasize some of the hypotheses of my book and my research that, you know, some of the first things that the UAE did openly was engage with Israel in many of these services. This really is because they are sensitive to developments within their own country and from, you know, domestic security threats.
I just wanted to finish by asking you how you think your book will be received in governments, sure, both in the UK and the UAE. As you mentioned at the beginning, from the outset, it appears that the Foreign Office weren't trying very hard to help you, and that may well be because they didn't want to introduce any grit into the relationship with the UAE. And similarly, whilst your book might not be widely available in the UAE, I'm sure it will be read with interest in certain quarters. So what's your expectation of that?
Sure. So one of the first things I talk about is the change in laws in regards to secretive information, at which it's made clear that it could be open information. It doesn't matter on the actual nature of it being secretive or not. If it's arbitrarily deemed to be secretive, then that's the case within the UAE. From the UK's perspective, this really simply is academic research. I'm not coming forward with anything new. It's just coming forward publicly with information that may be against the grain or against, you know, those open discussions. It should really help and underscore a different perception to which the UAE has tried to monopolize, that it is a strong and stable state. It's to help contribute to a discussion and debate about what that country really is and stands for, and where it's going in the future. From the UAE's perspective, of course, I know they, I think it's quite clear that they didn't like my PhD and what was in it. But the fact that during the court case, they actually did have the charges reduced from handling secret information to handling sensitive information. And that distinction is huge. It does more so actually highlight the thesis itself, that it is an insecure state that is highly sensitive to domestic affairs. I assume the book will be banned. But it is an interesting read from an external perspective. I'm ready to engage with persons who disagree, but it's based on fact. There aren't many other books or articles written about the UAE. Hopefully my book does present a certain perspective for people to look into themselves.
Well, as someone who's had the privilege of reading it, it definitely does. And let us hope that it becomes an underground classic in the UAE, passed secretly from house to house. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us in the bunker to talk about your own extraordinary personal story, but also your very important book and your really important academic work.
Thank you very much for having me, Arthur. Have a nice day.
Listeners, remember there's a new Bunker Daily every Wednesday, Thursday and Sunday, with Start Your Week on Mondays, the main panel show on Tuesdays and the Culture Bunker on Saturdays. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss out on any new episodes. If you like this episode, why not share it with three friends using the Bunker Up hashtag? You can also back the Bunker on the crowdfunding platform Patreon. Just see our Twitter or Facebook or search Patreon Bunker Podcast. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
The Bunker Daily was presented by Arthur Snell. The group editor was Andrew Harrison. The lead producer was Jacob Jarvis. And the producers were Jacob Archbold, Yelena Sofronievich, and me, Alex Rees. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.
It's a busy world out there. Once you've woken up and got on top of all your WhatsApps, your texts, your emails and your DMs, then you've got another pile of stuff to get through. The news. Honestly, who's got the time? That's where Papercuts, the brand new podcast, comes in. Papercuts is your fast, funny tour of all the best bits of the papers, from the biggest scoops to the weirdest headlines to the definitely not made up showbiz gossip. And it's out every weekday with me, Miranda Sawyer, and a host of guests, including tip-top comedian Marcus Brigstock. Marcus, what's your favourite thing about Papercuts?
It's the puns. It's obviously the puns. I mean, when we go through the papers and you see what creative beauties the people who work, particularly in the tabloids, have come up with. Often I think it's pun first, then story for them. They're like, I've got one. Find a story to match this. But it's a really fun part of the podcast to see what they've come up with every day.
Especially the Daily Star.
Oh, the Star. Proud to love animals.
So if you want to be on top of the news and have a laugh while you're doing it, get Papercuts every day on your favourite podcast app. We're out around lunchtime, Monday to Friday. Perfect for a bit of me time in the middle of a busy day. That's Papercuts. We read the papers so you don't have to. Thank you.